Papa, non, en 2024, créer un site web n'est plus une galère, c'est même devenu ultra simple, et notamment grâce à des solutions comme Squarespace. Squarespace est la plateforme tout en un pour permettre aux entrepreneurs de se démarquer et réussir en ligne, et ce, quelle que soit la taille de leur activité. Vous allez voir, tout y est. Vous pouvez vendre vos produits physiques ou services en un temps record. Vous avez des centaines de templates de sites web canon dans tous les domaines. Vous pouvez créer vos campagnes email. Vous pouvez même vendre votre propre formation en ligne. Donc, si vous voulez donner à votre business toutes les chances de se développer avec un outil à la fois performant et très simple d'utilisation, eh ben, je ne peux que vous recommander d'aller sur le site squarespace.com. En plus, à l'occasion de ce partenariat, Squarespace vous offre moins 10% sur votre première commande de site web ou de domaine avec le code Pauline. Alors, n'attendez plus et rendez-vous sur squarespace.com, code Pauline. Hello, hello les amis, j'espère que vous allez bien, j'espère surtout que vous avez passé de bonnes vacances. Cet épisode, c'est évidemment l'épisode de rentrée et il fallait que je marque un grand coup. Je vous mitonne ça depuis des mois et des mois, ça fait un moment que j'en parle sur mes réseaux sociaux et j'avais vraiment, vraiment envie de vous préparer un épisode très spécial pour cet été, pour cette rentrée. Je vous ai réservé, chers amis, ma première interview avec un invité international et d'une stature absolument remarquable, en l'occurrence. Pas de panique, c'est un épisode en anglais. Je vous préviens, pour honorer ce premier épisode, j'ai pas choisi un petit joueur. Je vous ai donc sorti un invité pépite de chez Pépite. Vous connaissez son nom. Il s'agit de Seth Godin. Seth Godin, vous savez, c'est ce ponte du marketing, une personne que j'admire pour ma part depuis très longtemps. Il a écrit un nombre de best-sellers internationaux incalculables, This is Marketing, que je vous recommande, The Purple Cow, qui pour moi en plus a vraiment une valeur profondément sentimentale parce que c'est ce livre qui m'a beaucoup inspiré dans ma carrière, et on en parlera d'ailleurs dans l'épisode, à un moment donné pour faire décoller ma propre entreprise, pour faire décoller Gemio. Ce livre a été pour moi un élément déclencheur qui m'a fait prendre conscience que pour ma marque, donc, il fallait que j'arrive à trouver des éléments tellement différents, tellement remarquables, que j'allais devoir prendre des risques. Et c'est ce que j'ai fait grâce à Seth. Donc, d'où le fait que cette interview avait vraiment une valeur particulière pour moi. Bref, vous l'aurez compris, Seth, c'est un peu mon idole. Je suis un petit peu groupie, je dois vous le dire. Donc, j'étais quand même un peu impressionnée, mais d'autant plus contente de l'interviewer. Et d'ailleurs, cet épisode est également disponible en format YouTube pour ceux que ça intéresse et qui auraient envie de voir nos interactions sur YouTube, même si ça s'est passé à distance. En plus, l'humour pince sans rire de Seth, ses réponses toujours une grande profondeur et sa grande justesse, j'en suis sûre, vont avoir également beaucoup d'effets pour vous. Mais je ne vous en dis pas plus et laisse place à my first interview in English with Seth Godin. Welcome, Seth, to my podcast.
It's a pleasure. Good to see you.
I am extremely honored to have you. To tell you the truth, you're my first also English interview, so there's a lot of pressure on the language for me. But as you, I know you're very subtle in your way of speaking, it's going to be just fine. And I'm very, very happy to make you even more known on a French audience. So thank you so much to have accepted this invitation.
Well, the pressure is on me because all your listeners are trying to figure out why I'm not speaking French.
Well, you know, we can arrange a few lessons if you wish. Anyway, I wanted to start directly by a quote that I saw from you that I thought extremely deep. And my mission with this podcast is really to help people. And I thought this quote would probably help a lot of people. I would love you to elaborate on it. This is the quote. It says, "The brilliant idea that changes everything for people is realizing that responsibility is never given, it's taken. And if you choose to take responsibility, all these doors are opened up." This is absolutely, honestly, dashing with intelligence. I would love you to elaborate and just tell me what you meant by that. Maybe have an example what you referred to.
I'll try, and help me if the words don't translate well into French. Most of us are brainwashed, indoctrinated from a young age to seek authority. So we ask the teacher, will this be on the test? We raise our hand if we need to go to the bathroom. When we get a job, we want to know who can tell us what to do and who can we tell what to do. So authority is at the heart of the industrial system, who's in charge. And it's so easy to let ourselves off the hook because we say, wait, I don't have the authority to do that. But it turns out change almost always comes from people who instead are eager for responsibility. Responsibility is, I made this, I'm responsible for this, I did this, you can blame me, here I am. And in most organizations, anyone who wants responsibility can have it. You don't have to ask permission. You can just take it. And once we start taking responsibility, even though the world is unjust, even though we don't get the benefit of the doubt, even though caste systems and colonialism and everything else have made it hard, if we take responsibility, everything gets easier.
Do you think this is also something that's relevant in terms of marketing? What I mean by that is sometimes, you know, it's difficult to have your brand made known, build up brand awareness. And I find people find often excuses because it is hard. And maybe, I mean, you could also elaborate on this, but I don't know if you feel this is relevant.
Oh, it's very relevant. I mean, if we look at how social media has ruined so many people's lives, it's also made brands resistant to doing important work because they say, I have to do this or I won't get any likes or views. I have to do this because it's what everybody wants. And so we make things that are more shallow. We try to make things shorter, more convenient, simpler. And then we say, I had no choice. It was the only way to grow what I did, right? You get bombarded, I'm sure, every day I do, from people who say, can I be a guest? Can I be pitching this and pitching this? I stumble. Well, I say, well, why are you spamming a list? And they're like, well, I have no choice. It's the only way to, quote, get the word out. So you're not taking responsibility. You're just blaming the system. And as a result, you're making lousy work that you're not proud of. And I know that there's another path, that there are marketers who say, yeah, I don't want to be a Kardashian. I don't want to figure out how to make Twitter happy. I want to do work I'm proud of. But to do that, you have to take responsibility.
So does that mean going in a way all the way? That means really going through difficult things, taking risks?
Well, I'm not sure they're risks. I think they're the opposite of risks. They just feel risky. But my point is the easy path is really filled with people that you're not going to be able to stand out among. The difficult path is a privilege. What a treat to be able to do something that everyone else is too lazy or afraid to do. That is the opportunity.
This is very interesting because most people know you as a marketer, but actually I would argue that you're an entrepreneur and through and through, a damn good one at it too. So if we take a huge step back, I'd like to follow up on this lead of taking risks, of not, you know, being the same person as the others. How would you say that your career as an entrepreneur has maybe changed you in your beliefs? Do you have any insights basically that you pondered upon during all these years as being yourself an entrepreneur that you could share?
So there's an old joke in the United States that the French are so bad at starting businesses, they don't even have a word for entrepreneur.
I know.
And to translate that, it's because entrepreneur is a French word. To be an entrepreneur is to solve problems, to figure out how to raise money or capital or time to build something bigger than yourself to solve a problem. If you're not solving a problem for someone, then you're hustling. You're not actually an entrepreneur. So I've been an entrepreneur for a long time. I started one of the first internet companies. I haven't been as financially successful as some, but I'm super proud of what we were able to build. And each time it's because we started with the problem, not what is our problem, but what is the problem our customers have. And when we can bring that to the fore, we can build something that matters. And too often people who want to make a difference have been pushed to hustle and to find a shortcut, when in fact, what we need, I think, to do is build something that lasts.
Yeah, for sure. Could you walk us through how you had, for instance, one of your entrepreneurial ideas? Could be a book, could be one of your companies. I mean, for me, they're all entrepreneurship in a way, because it's something, as you mentioned, bigger than yourself. And the process of identifying a need or a suffering, as you were mentioning it.
I'll tell you the most recent one, and I'll tell you one of the very first ones. The most recent one, I'm a volunteer, so it's not about making a profit. It's called The Carbon Almanac. It's coming out around the world in a couple months in this summer. And it is written with hundreds of other people in more than 40 countries around the world. What's the problem? The problem is that smart, caring people are confused and intimidated by what's going on in the climate and are afraid to talk about it because they're confused and intimidated. So I said, what would happen if a whole bunch of people came together and clarified this? Would that help solve other people's problems? And it's been one of the privileges in my life to work on that for the last 6 months. One of the very first projects I did that didn't work was in the United States. If you are a member of a musical group, a high school band, if the high school band wants to have any money, they have to go raise it with a fundraiser. And many of the high school bands would raise money by selling fruit, which is a ridiculous thing to sell because it's really expensive and it goes rotten and it's heavy. So they would come around and you'd order a big box of oranges and then it would show up 3 months later. And I know this from personal experience because I was in a band. And I said, do you know what's not heavy, not expensive, and never goes bad? Light bulbs. So I made a deal with the biggest light bulb factory in Hungary to be able to obtain truckloads of light bulbs. And they were 10 cents each. And the idea would be that a band could sell them door to door for a dollar each. And everyone needs light bulbs. And this was a great idea. It would solve the band's problems. And it failed. And I can talk forever about why it failed. But the point is, that's what entrepreneurs do, is they say, who needs something? Can I get it for them and create the conditions for it to spread?
So for you as an entrepreneur, what have been, if you can take like a huge step back, one of your own personal most important difficulties? Some people have issues because they're not good at management. Some people are not good at marketing. I'm pretty sure that's not your case. What have been your hardships and how have you tried to overcome them?
I would say at the beginning, my biggest hardship was my relationship with money. And when you are an entrepreneur, particularly if you've raised money, you need to spend it like it's not your money. And that was very hard because I bootstrapped my way into where I was. And I was really careful with every dollar. And as a result, we missed an enormous number of opportunities because we didn't invest, because I viewed paying for things as an expense, not an investment. And that shift is very difficult for a lot of entrepreneurs to make. I also realized along the way that I'm terrible at managing because I don't want to do it. I'm a leader, not a manager, and they're different things. And in French, are they different words, leadership and management?
Yeah, they do. Actually, we use a lot of English words for this. We say manager and leader, so you see.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure there's that committee in France that's really angry that you're using English words, but what can I do about it? Anyway, managers use power and authority to get what they got yesterday, but faster and cheaper. And I know your burgeoning company has more than 70 people in it now. Some of those people signed up to be managed. Tell me when my shift starts. Tell me what to do all day. Tell me how to get an A. Leadership is voluntary. Leadership is, I'm going over there. Do you want to come? And when I built my internet company, we got up to about 70 people, more, 75 people, and 50 of them reported directly to me because I was just running a circus and I wasn't willing to build a managerial structure. And once I realized how much of a burden it was for me and for other people, I just said, I'm not going to do that anymore. So most of my projects ever since then have been much smaller because I can lead. I don't have to manage.
I'd love for you to elaborate on that because I think a lot of the people that are listening to us are exactly in that situation that they think they have to be a manager. You know, it's going all the way back to my first question about taking responsibility. And they think it's impossible to be just a leader. So I would love for you to go through like maybe the psychological things that went through your head and also how you announced it to, you know, actually say, okay, I'm going to step down as manager and be a leader.
So if you go to Rue de Cherche-Midi in Paris to number 18, you can go to the Poulain, which is a miracle. And Apollonia is a dear friend of mine. And if you look at...
Oh, you know, she's been on the podcast.
Well,
sorry,
that's why I said yes. and if you go to Poulain, the punitions are as good as they've ever been, and so are the beautiful loaves of bread. Apollonia is not in the manufactorium watching the baker every day. Somebody else is managing the process. She is leading them forward by establishing new standards and new frontiers. But when she took over after her father tragically passed, she had to manage. Because if she didn't, the place would have faded into obscurity. She had to say, no, this isn't the way we do it. We do it this way. And so as you evolve your organization, you have to decide which jobs do you want? Do you want the job of the checklists and making sure that everything's the same as it was yesterday? Or do you want the scarier job of leading the person who's managing and confronting the unknown? And any successful organization that you see has somebody who's figured out how to manage. The ones that are fading away, and these are mostly big companies, forgot to keep leading. They keep doing what they did yesterday and they're just going to fade away. And I worked at Yahoo for a while. I saw it happen firsthand. Yahoo had leaders and then all the leaders left the building and all they had was managers.
Mm. Very inspiring, I think, for a lot of people who are going to be listening to us and who will, I'm sure, think about themselves. I wanted to do a quick segue to quitting. I read your book, The Dip. And so the secondary title is When to Quit and When to Stick. This is probably one of the most common questions I get all the time. People telling me, should I continue? Should I like continue hitting my head on a wall, you know, and like just persevere? We're talking about entrepreneurship. So perseverance is supposed to be one of the main qualities. And we know that success takes time and patience. Yet sometimes, as you say, it's in this book, it's just not the right thing to pursue. And you just have to quit. Could you elaborate on this also and tell me what are your main thoughts and maybe very common mistakes that you see around you?
So the purpose of the book wasn't to tell people when to quit. It was to help them realize they should decide. That it was simply to highlight. It was the first book ever on quitting and the only bestseller that I know of on quitting. And what it said was quitting is a skill. And quitting is important, that if you took ballet lessons when you were three, you're probably not still a ballerina. You quit along the way. Anybody who has figured out how to do things of value has quit other things. And the core ideas are there are huge benefits to being seen as the best in the world. That if you have the best restaurant in Paris, there will never be an empty table because the people who want the best one will find you. So how are you going to be the best at something? You're going to be the best at something by quitting other things. So you have the resources to be the best at that thing. And the question that you're asking is, how do I know when to quit on my path to building a thing? And my answer is, thanks for asking the question. That was the hard part. Number two, has anyone with the resources you have ever gone from where you are to where you want to go? Or are you going to be the first one? So you are building an important and vibrant jewelry business. Has anybody in your shoes ever done that before? Yes. Right? And I don't know how far you are down the street from where Coco Chanel built her thing, but probably not that far. It has been
done.
Not
yet.
It has been done.
I need more of Seth's advice, I think.
So you know that there is a path. Whereas if you say, I'm, you know, living in this garret in Lyon and I'm going to be a famous rock star. Well, in the last 10 years, that hasn't happened. That's just a lottery. You can't persevere your way to the other side just by trying harder. So maybe you should spend your time doing something else. And so what we look for is there a path that has a dip in it, a hard part? Because we want there to be a hard part. If there's no hard part, if all you have to do is buy some Dogecoin and then tomorrow you're going to be a millionaire, you can bet that's a scam. Because if there's no hard part, it's unlikely that there's going to be value created on the other side.
When did you have the idea of this book? I was interested by this because I thought, is it something that came from a personal story? Is it also a question that a lot of people ask you? I mean, we all know the dip, entrepreneur or not. But to be, you know, so interested in this subject to actually write a book about it and make a bestseller, as you were talking about it very justly, that's a bestseller on quitting. This is a very far-fetched idea. So I was wondering how it came up.
Ideas are interesting to me because the near-fetched ideas have all been taken. And it was more than 10 years ago, so I don't remember exactly what spurred it. I know that enough people brought it up that I thought, this is something people are concerned about. And I also probably was dealing with the issues myself. I remember what I did when I sold my company and what I did when I shut down the one after that. And when I decided to sell this or to walk away from that. And so if it's that pervasive and no one's ever described the challenge, I thought, well, let's see. And it only took me 3 weeks to write the book. And then I looked at it and I said, yeah, I'd be happy to put my name on it.
You know, I mentioned when we started chatting that I was deeply inspired by The Purple Cow. And it had really an impact on my life. So, I mean, I'm sure as an author, you hear that all the time, but to really have literally changed the course of a company is what happened with this book. And so I wanted to, you know, pay a tribute to that, first of all. And for me, the genius of that book and many of the books I've read is not only in the idea, it's also in the simplicity of the way you're able to, translate this idea. And I find that quite remarkable because, to be honest, most marketing books or most business books try to be smart, try to be a little complicated in a way. And so my reaction to this is always, oh my God, this is so obvious. Why did I not think about it, you know? But you are the guy who's there to think about it. So I was wondering if this quest of simplicity, in a way, is something that you really try to do, because I know you'd like to help people, educate them, help them out, basically. And so I find this really very, very important, like to be able to pass on a message in a very simple yet powerful way.
When was the last time you talked to one of the customers of your business?
I talk to them very frequently. I go in my shop practically like every week.
And when you're talking to them, do you pay attention to what makes their eyes light up, to what they like?
I try to.
Yeah. Most people who are writing a book are afraid. They are afraid of being judged. They are afraid of being misunderstood. And so the resistance causes them to make it more and more complicated. What I do is I teach somebody the ideas in the book face to face. If their eyes don't light up, I haven't done a very good job. If you can do it with another human, you can write it down. And this is the problem that so many entrepreneurs have with their businesses. Their businesses are small and struggling, and they're saying, well, once I'm big, all those problems will go away. No, those problems will get worse. Figure out how to delight 10 people so much that they tell their friends. If you can't do that, you don't have anything. Delight 10 people. So if I write something, right, and people don't get the story and they don't get the joke, then I got to write it again. I don't get to just say, I'll make it more complicated and then say it's a book.
Extremely interesting. And I think this is an excuse again. We're again talking about taking responsibility that, I mean, entrepreneurs, but also like people in their families, managers probably find, you know, oh no, but I mean, it's not the right person. It's not the right setting or whatever, but actually you just have to try over and over again. Is it something that you actually still do right now? I mean, like the today Seth Godin that has had such a long career and such an experience in writing books, for instance. Is it something that you still physically do to actually like push your content, I don't know, maybe on your newsletter, on people directly so that they can judge you in a way beforehand?
So it's really important to understand that 99% of the people in the world have never read a word I've written. And even in the United States, where I've had 20 bestsellers, almost nobody has read one of my books. That's fine with me. But what it means is I don't just get to show up and get instant benefit of the doubt from people because they don't know who I am anyway. So with the Carbon Almanac, I had to persuade all these volunteers to join on. I had to persuade them to write something in a way that I thought would work. I had to describe it to them. And at the beginning, they didn't get it. So I changed what it was, right? And so all of the stuff I'm doing, yeah, I can now write a blog post without testing it on people because the blog itself is a test. But before I'm going to spend months of my life building a thing, I talk to people. And, you know, what someone quoted me on a podcast last week, don't do market research. Make sales calls. If someone's willing to sell, to buy what you sell, that is the best market research of all.
And what's very interesting is that you were extremely I don't know the word in English, but précurseur. So my French audience is going to understand, but you were very, very early on when you started actually these testing via the blog, for instance, because now, I mean, everyone's talking about it on social media, etc. But to actually be able to do this like 10, 15 years ago, that's something else. Do you still see now the blog and all the content that you put out, which is huge, as also a way for you to find ideas? I'm pretty sure it is the case, but is it also your way of being creative?
The people I'm most inspired by are my readers. What you told me before the podcast started about the impact of my work on what you did and the way it had an impact, that's magic. And when I interact with people who are frustrated or stuck, that is the source of what I'm going to be talking about. So I would write my blog even if no one read it. That, I don't write it as a business tool. Mm. I write it because I'm a teacher and it's a place to teach. And most of the people I know who have built resilient, successful careers, that is their mindset. If you talk to a doctor, they would tell you that the thing that made them a better doctor is their patients.
Yeah, and the fact that they actually care about the people they're saving. I know you don't want to talk about yourself, Seth, but I'm going to have to ask you a few questions about little Seth. And if you don't mind, I would love to start by going back all the way to your childhood. If you could talk about where you were raised, how was your family? And maybe most importantly for me, how was little Seth? Were you super turbulent? Did you already want to stand out? Like, how did you have this epiphany that in life, you know, you just have to stand out at one point?
So let me tell you why this is a trap. And with full respect. So I was born with plenty of privilege and great parents. And I've been healthy most of my life and gotten the benefit of the doubt. But it's really easy in our current person-obsessed social media world to say, well, that person could do it because they had this, and that person could do it because they had that. And if I only was an orphan, then I could be Jeff Bezos, right? And he's not an orphan, he's half an orphan. But the point is still, we create these biographies of the other as a way of supposedly inspiring us, but it actually does the opposite. Because it amplifies the myth of talent, the things we are born with. And when I have talked about my childhood online, my sisters have said, that may have been your experience, but we don't think we grew up in the same house as you. So what's really going on here is we do things and then we make up a backstory as to why and how they work. Was I obnoxious when I was a kid? There's no question about it. I've been told that by reliable sources. Does that mean if you weren't obnoxious as a kid, you can't be a teacher and a leader and an entrepreneur? Of course not. They're not related. And so I've studied leaders around the world. And the only thing they have in common is they decided to lead. And that is the core of what people need to take away. It's a choice. It is not about where you came from.
That's a very important message, and I thank you for it. So maybe my second question would be, when did you decide that you wanted to lead? Do you remember? Was it a specific moment?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think that there were several times it happened. When I was in high school, the school where I was going had just been built and they didn't have a cafeteria. And I thought that was a problem because you had a whole bunch of hungry teenagers there every day for lunch. And so I don't even know if I asked anyone's permission. Maybe I did. I just called up a company that wholesaled ice cream sandwiches. And your listeners don't know what an ice cream sandwich is, but it's a...
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they can figure it out.
It's a very commercial thing in the United States. It's a not very good cookie with not very good ice cream and another not very good cookie on top. And I ordered 300 ice cream sandwiches and had them delivered to the school and then sold them and used the money again for the band. And I had just a blast doing it. And I didn't make any money. I didn't do it to make any money. And I said, this is what I do. I don't take good notes in class. I'm never going to be the person who gets the most A's. But I saw a problem and I just decided that I was going to do something about it. And then I had one real job. And when I got there, I was the 30th employee. It was the first day in the new office. And you don't remember this, but there used to be a time when there was no voicemail and there was no email. And there were phones that receptionists would answer. And if you weren't in the office, they would write down the note on a pink slip and put it in a little box so you could pick up your messages. And this thing they put the messages in was round and had 30 slots in it. And each slot had each person's name on it. But the names weren't in alphabetical order. They were in the order that you joined the company. So what you had to do when you came back from lunch or a meeting is you had to spin and spin and spin and spin until you found your name, and then you could pull out your messages. And I had just gotten there, and I walked up to the thing, and I thought, this is a problem. I'm going to have to spin and spin and spin every day. So I grabbed a paperclip from the receptionist's bowl, and I put it on my name. So now I just had to spin to the paperclip. And within 3 hours, every single one of the slots had some different kind of flag or pipe cleaner or paperclip on it because I had solved the problem. And I still remember this how many years later, 35 years later, because that was a choice. This carousel had been there for weeks or months and no one had ever done anything to it. Mm. And that was better because I invested a paperclip. And that's just what I decided I wanted to do.
Extremely interesting. I thank you so much, Seth. We still have 10 minutes together, so I have a few last quick questions. First question is very important for the audience, I know. It's about a great failure. Have you ever had a great failure? And most importantly, the lesson or the lessons that you took from it.
My biggest failures, without a doubt, have been the failures of omission, not commission. I have definitely committed affronts. I've hurt people. I've made mistakes, but they pale in comparison to the things I haven't done. And I haven't reached out to people who needed me when I could have. I didn't see the internet early. When I was on the internet, I didn't understand what the World Wide Web was. That cost me billions of dollars. I didn't take the time to think about how the world was changing and my role in it early enough. I didn't speak up early and often about injustice or even climate. And so as I get older, that's what I'm trying to pay attention to, is not how do I avoid making a mistake? It's how do I avoid being silent?
Then I had to ask you a question, Seth. What don't you want to be silent about right now with my audience?
Well, the reason I've invested all of my time every day, 15 hours a day on the climate almanac, carbon almanac, is because nobody wants to talk about our problem. And it is not just a problem for rich countries and rich people. It is a problem for everybody. There is only one planet in the universe that can support us. We don't have to catastrophize it. We have a systems problem. And we need a systems solution. So this isn't about recycling your plastic. This is because you can't. This is about changing the system. And if enough people who listen to this speak up, it's amazing how fast the system will change. And when we speak up, people listen. And my hope is that it will start happening much more than it already has.
I must say, to be honest, that, I mean, France, of course, is not a country that is perfect at all. And Europe is not, you know, a continent that's at all perfect on this regard. But I've seen a lot of differences between the US and Europe because I go sometimes there. And I must say that in terms of mindset, mentality, also the difference is huge. I think we've been talking about this for a long time. I'm not saying there's much that's being done.
Right.
But at least.
No, I mean, there's no question that certain countries in Europe are leading the way in getting toward carbon neutral, but carbon neutral isn't going to be sufficient. And what is so here's just one statistic that I think is really fascinating. Last year, we made 1 trillion plastic bags. That's with a T. I can't recall the last time humanity made 1 trillion of anything. And they're so convenient and they're so cheap. And so we ship things that are wrapped in plastic, that are wrapped in plastic, that are wrapped in plastic. And that's not just in the United States. I've been everywhere in the world and it has spread. Well, we can't say to someone, please don't use plastic bags. That's not going to work. We just have to make them against the law. That will work. That's what systems change looks like.
Very clear. Another question for you. If you could change anything in your personal, in your professional life, what would you do differently?
I wish I could speak French.
Good answer.
Everyone who can speak French seems so smart and sophisticated.
Well, you know, if you want to drop by in France for the holiday maybe season, you know, I'll be very happy to go to Apollonia Poelan with you. We'll have some tea, some cookies, French bread, and we'll talk French. Is there a quote, words of wisdom that really mean something to you that sometimes, you know, you rethink about, maybe you've written them down that you could share with us?
Well, I'm sort of in the pithy quote business. And I think what I have discovered is that no quote by itself changes anybody. The question is, where do we want to go? And so when I think about making things better by making better things, I can say that to people and they'll just go, whatever. But if you say it to someone who deeply wants to make things better by making better things, it becomes a slogan. And slogans are really useful because they refocus our energy when we are too distracted. So what I would say to people is, what change are you seeking to make in the world? And what slogan would help remind you of that?
I also have what I call my non-politically correct question. Is there something you believe that is usually not widely believed? So for example, a guest on my podcast is very into neuroscience and cognitive biases and told me people believe that older people are wiser. It's just not the case. They actually have more biases. So is there anything that you really think is an error, or at least you don't judge it's, you know, I mean, there's no judgment, but at least you're not, you don't agree with most of a widely spread belief?
Oh, I have so many of these.
You're the right person to ask this question, I know.
I love placebos. I think we should seek out placebos and not say that's just a placebo. I think talent is largely a myth. I think the amount of caste and unfair bias in our society worldwide is largely underreported. I think that giving the benefit of the doubt to people who have something to say is rarely appropriately allocated. I think horoscopes make absolutely no sense and they're clearly nonsense, that there's definitely life on other planets, but they've never been here before. And I had one more. And we don't have free will. Free will is a myth. It's just a story we tell ourselves to explain how we behave.
Seth, you're dropping bombs. We only have 4 minutes left. How am I gonna do this? And I still have two more questions. So maybe one day I'll have the privilege to have another session of questions with you, and then I'll take this list again and we'll go down through it in details, if you agree. But anyway, passing on to the next question, is there a subject on which you have changed your mind?
Yes, I've changed my mind the most profoundly in 1 second about the World Wide Web in 1993 or four. And in the last 6 months about climate, about how deeply we have been brainwashed, about carbon footprint and about plastic and about hope. I've changed my mind so dramatically, you can hear it from France.
Yeah. This happened only 6 months ago?
Yeah.
This last change of mind?
When people discover that only 6% of the plastic has ever been recycled, and that every time you throw plastic recycling in the bin, you are wasting your time and being manipulated by the plastics industry, they get very angry with me, right? And when we discover that the carbon footprint was invented by British Petroleum to make us feel bad, they get very angry at me. It took me a long time to get my arms around that kind of thinking.
Last question. Is there a book that has had a great impact on you? Maybe the greatest impact, maybe that made you change your mind, maybe made you become the person you are right now?
There are way too many to mention, so that's why I'm going to pick one that will surprise people. It's called Linchpin and I wrote it. And the reason that I'm mentioning it is not because I need you to buy it, because I don't care whether you buy it or not, but because I think you should write a book. And I think you should write a book. I think if you wrote a book, I would be delighted to read it. The book you write is the book that will change you the most.
Best answer. Seth, thank you so much for your time. I deeply, deeply appreciate it. Most importantly, I'm sure the audience will too. Don't hesitate, by the way, audience, to go and check out all the content of Seth, especially the newsletter, which is amazing. Seth, if we want to follow you, can you lead our audience to know what's the best way to be in contact with you, or at least to follow your adventures?
If you go to your favorite search engine, mine is Ecosia, E-C-O-S-I-A, and type my name in, there I am. Seth, S-E-T-H is all you have to type.
Thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for doing this.
Bye bye les amis, c'est la fin de cet épisode, mais avant de vous quitter, quelques détails en plus. D'abord, pour toutes les infos sur le podcast et cet épisode, ça se passe sur polynenio.com, vous aurez tout promis, juré. Aussi, si vous souhaitez me contacter pour me poser des questions ou me proposer de nouveaux invités, eh bien n'hésitez pas à le faire directement sur LinkedIn, Instagram ou YouTube, je vous attends. Enfin, encore mille merci de m'avoir écouté jusqu'ici, j'espère de tout cœur que ça vous a plu et je vous dis à très vite pour un nouvel épisode.